Thank you for attending session 335, titled Popularizing Utah Women's History, Connecting Threads from Past, Present, and Future. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. We ask that as you go through your day, you reflect on all the diversity you have experienced so far at Sunstone. Let the things that both uplift you and make you uncomfortable be teachers in your own journey. As you listen to the sessions today, ponder the gifts you have to give to the Mormon community and how you can share them in the fabric of such diversity. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Concessions will be open in the venue for lunch, or you are welcome to visit local restaurants in the area. Please return by 1:45 to get a seat in the next session. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your programs, this presentation description is as follows. The year 2020 commemorates the 150th anniversary of the Utah Territory extending to women the right to vote, the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, and the 55th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. Many people do not know the key role that Utah and Mormons played in this history, but Better Days 2020 is dedicated to popularizing Utah women's history through education, legislation, and art. Come rediscover this history. Our panel here, you may know them. If you don't, I'm going to read your bios here and indicate by raise of the right hand who you are. Okay. Jen Christensen is the legislative director for Better Days 2020. Her most recent efforts include the Send Martha campaign to place a statue of Dr. Martha Hughes Cannon in Washington, D.C., and a First to Vote license plate available in October 2018. Catherine Kitterman is the historical director for Better Days 2020 and a PhD candidate in American history at American University. Her research analyzes the rhetoric of Mormon women's struggle for suffrage in 19th century Utah, highlighting the connection between suffragists on the West and East Coasts. Naomi Watkins is the Director of Education for Better Days 2020 and the co-founder of Aspiring Mormon Women, a nonprofit that supports LDS women's professional and educational endeavors. She has a PhD from the University of Utah and developed UtahWomen'sHistory.org, a Better Days 2020 initiative. I'll turn the time over to our presenters.
When Sarah Young dropped her ballot into the box on February 14, 1870, she became the first woman in the modern nation to vote. And it was 50 more years before the 19th Amendment was passed in 1920, and another 45 years before the Voting Rights Act, which actually made it possible for women across the United States to finally have the legal right to start voting. That story, and the story of what happened between those dates, is part of what we're here to talk to you about today. In the year 2020, we'll be celebrating all three of those anniversaries, the 150th anniversary of women voting, the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, and the 55th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. Better Days 2020 was founded because those stories haven't been told. Did you know that Utahns were the first to vote? Did you know that Emmeline B. Wells met four U.S. presidents in her advocacy? Did you know that Utah elected the first woman to be a state senator? These stories have been lost. They're not told in schools. We don't talk about them. They're not memorialized in art. And Better Days 2020 has, our mission is to popularize Utah women's history, to use art, education, and legislation to bring those stories back and forward. There's three purposes of our campaign. We want to start talking about those again. We want to give Utahns the knowledge and the tools to bring those stories forward, and we want to take and empower and involve women in Utah's business, political, and educational communities so that they can start talking about those things. So we're going to dive today into that history, and Catherine's going to do that for us.
Too short for this. So as Jen mentioned, Utah women became the first to vote in the modern U.S.
when 26 women cast their ballots in the Salt Lake City municipal election in February of 1870. So the questions, so this is a really interesting story in and of itself. It's an interesting soundbite that Utah women were the first to actually cast votes. We know that Wyoming was the first territory to extend voting rights to women, but they didn't have an election until later. But it's not just that little story that we're talking about, but we want to talk about why this was happening, what it meant for women, and what Utah women did partially to gain those rights in the first place, fighting when they were under attack, and then to regain them in the state constitution in 1895. So we're going to talk a little bit today about why Utah and why 1870 for this expansion of voting rights to women in the first place. And then we'll talk a little bit about what that meant for Utah women then and what that can mean for Utah women today and how we're working to infuse that into Utah's popular culture. So in 1870, or in early 1870, late 1869, there were several reasons why suffrage for Utah women was a topic of conversation, both nationally and locally. And there was support for women's voting rights in Utah from several different groups. And if you can think about the context of national history here, we're talking about the end of the Civil War. The women's rights movement had kind of put their campaigning on hold for women's rights during the Civil War. Afterward, they thought, this is our time. And then with the 15th Amendment in 1869, women were left out of that expansion of voting rights to African-American men. So there's a suffrage component here where national suffragists felt like this is our chance to experiment with suffrage somewhere. And a few congressmen proposed ideas to enfranchise Utah women as perhaps a safe place where that could be experimented with, partially because it's far away in the West. Nobody cares about what's going on out there. Partially because if it worked, it could be seen as an experiment that would then inspire other states to do the same. And these suffragists allied themselves with anti-polygamists because their argument was not only that this would be a place to experiment with women's rights and see what women could do, but also that it would be a way to possibly end Mormon polygamy. So those purposes were very intertwined. Anti-polygamists believed that if women had the right to vote in Utah, that they would vote out Mormon leaders, vote against polygamy, and their oppression at the hands of Mormon men. And so Congressman Julian of Indiana introduced several bills that proposed enfranchising Mormon women as a way, or Utah women, as a way then to undercut polygamy and also experiment with women's rights. Unfortunately for him, as soon as the territorial delegate to Congress, William Hooper from Utah, found out about this, he said, that's a great idea. And finding out that Mormons in Utah were behind this killed the bill's chances in Congress. So no enfranchisement for Utah women from federal lawmakers. But that started a conversation locally. And Utah Mormon leaders had some reasons why they thought this would be a good idea. To counter that national narrative that women in Utah were oppressed and degraded, to show that we have given women more rights here than in other places. Also, some genuine beliefs in the equality of men and women. And then there's an interesting piece here where the Mormon women themselves get involved. Probably many of you have read Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's recent book about a house full of females, but the indignation meeting that she opens with in January 1870 is key for several reasons. It's the first indignation meeting planned by women and for women only in Utah, and thousands of women came to the Old Tabernacle to protest against proposed anti-polygamy legislation in Congress. So at that time, they didn't have any voting rights that would have been taken away, but they're protesting, in support of Mormon men. This shows that they're willing to take political action in support of their community, and that builds a case, possibly, in the eyes of Mormon leaders that Mormon women would be safe voters. There's also something else going on here, though. The week before this indignation meeting, as Mormon women of the 15th Ward in Salt Lake City are discussing this meeting and planning it, they vote in this planning meeting to demand the right of franchise from the Utah territorial governor. So you can see that some women are using this moment in time as a way to potentially advocate for their own rights and their own behalf. So all of these reasons come together in the Woman Suffrage Act of 1870. So the Utah Territorial Legislature unanimously passed this bill on February 10th. Then it was signed by the acting governor on February 12th, although he personally didn't. He personally opposed the bill. But this legislative act granted voting rights to every woman in the territory who was over 21, who had lived in the territory for 6 months, who was born or naturalized in the U.S., or the wife or daughter of a native born or naturalized citizen. And that's a little bit more expansive language in some ways than we see in other places. But you have to remember that this, of course, expands rights for some women, but of course there are other women who are implicitly left out of this story. Native American women and Asian women have no path to citizenship at this time in the U.S., so voting rights don't extend to them. But still, this is a historic occasion. But so as women begin to vote in Utah, there's a lot of national interest in what they're doing and how they're voting and why. And so the very reasons that many people in America supported women's voting rights in Utah initially become the very reasons why they oppose those voting rights later when they see how this plays out and how Mormon women in particular are actually voting. So as you can see here with some of these political cartoons, there are arguments that Mormon women are enslaved and degraded, that polygamy needs to be hewn down by the acts of federal legislation. But there's also then an argument that giving women the right to vote might actually increase the power of Mormon leaders in the territory. This argument was made before women were enfranchised, and you can see the caption here reads, "Female suffrage, wouldn't it put just a little too much power into the hands of Brigham Young and his tribe?" And you can see him here marching his wives and children to the polls to vote for the straight Democratic ticket. Horrors, right? But so there was this argument before by some naysayers who said, this might actually empower Mormon men. And then as Mormon women and Utah women in general are voting in Utah and nothing seems to be changing, this argument becomes the one that bubbles up to the forefront. And the idea that Mormon women's voting rights and Utah women's voting rights in general are actually upholding Mormon leaders and upholding polygamy changes that view then of whether Mormon suffrage or women's suffrage, is a good idea. And then it becomes, in legislators and anti-polygamous words, the liberty of self-degradation. So now voting rights in the hands of women have become a tool for them to continue their enslavement rather than a tool for empowerment. So there are several groups who oppose Mormon women's voting rights then in these years following 1870. One are the anti-polygamists, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. There are also legal challenges to that 1870 suffrage bill that the local liberal party brings against the bill. It's always upheld by the Utah courts, but there are three times where that bill is challenged in court. There are suffragists in general in the United States who are split over polygamy. Susan B. Anthony's most radical suffrage organization is the only one to defend Mormon women's voting rights, and the others are worried that the press that's coming to suffrage in the case of Utah will damage their cause, that the suffrage and liberty of self-degradation and all of these things will be wrapped up and then used against them in other states and other cases. So they want to distance themselves, and many of them actually do argue, in fact, for disenfranchising Utah women or Mormon women in particular. So Congress then attempted to revoke Utah women's voting rights almost every year, starting in 1878. And just as a reminder here, Congress has lawmaking authority over Utah because Utah is a territory at this time. So the anti-polygamists are sending petition after petition to Congress, asking them to enforce the anti-polygamy acts that are on the books, and then specifically also asking them to revoke Utah women's voting rights. As we know, they eventually would succeed in the Edmunds-Tucker Act of 1887, which you can see here. And I want to talk a little bit about Utah women's response, because there are several different responses from different communities within Utah, and they all play a role into how this happens. So as Mormon women feel that their votes are threatened, they begin a grassroots kind of a political movement here. They mobilize these organizational networks through the relief societies to send petitions back east. They cultivate ties with national suffrage leaders that will talk to them, which is Susan B. Anthony and the National Woman Suffrage Association. They send women back east to lobby personally to the president and his wife and some other things. And we'll talk about that later. But there's another response that comes up from women in Utah who are not LDS. And this is Jenny Froyseth in the Anti-Polygamy Society that's founded in 1878. So as Jenny and these other women form this Anti-Polygamy Society, they send circulars to Christian ministers across the nation, asking them to send petitions to Congress to disfranchise Mormon women or to enact stronger anti-polygamy laws. So there's a battle of petitions here, and I think this is fascinating because this is my dissertation topic, but I want to talk to you about a couple reasons why this is interesting and important for us to understand what women are doing. As Mormon women are arguing that they should not be disfranchised, they make several arguments based on this politically useful identity that they've already achieved in some way of voters, and they believe that that gives them a tie or a claim to citizenship, and they use that claim for citizenship to argue that these voting rights should be protected, that the government has some obligations to them because they have obligations to the government as well. And in 1878, they argue that, quote, we have exercised the ballot with our own free will and choice, having fully demonstrated that honorable women command as much respect at the polls as in the parlor and in the church. So there's one argument there that they're saying we have been independent voters. We're not voting the way Brigham Young is telling us to, although they happen to be voting the same way that Brigham Young is voting. That's not important here. They're arguing that they're making these choices by themselves. So that's one argument here. But then another argument that they make later on, before the Edmunds-Tucker Act is actually approved, is that they argue that these rights can't be taken away. In 1886, they turned to these rights as citizens when they protested the proposed Edmunds-Tucker Act, and they said this: the suffrage originally conferred upon us as a political privilege has become a vested right by possession and usage for 15 years, and we protest against being deprived of that right without process of law and for no other reason than that we do not vote to suit our political opponents. So an interesting argument here that maybe they saw this as a political privilege at first, but through their exercise and through the defense of their voting rights, they come to see these as a vested right. They come to see them in a more modern term. So whether or not you buy these Mormon women's arguments, the fact of what happens is that they don't win out. The anti-polygamy lobby is strong. Congress does disfranchise all Utah women in 1887. That's Mormon and non-Mormon, married or single. And then there's a question of what to do next. Where should we go? Some women, like Jenny Froiseth, the non-Mormon woman, are arguing that even though they're ardent suffragists in principle, they think that suffrage in the hands of Utah women has been too dangerous. Not just Mormon women, but all Utah women, she argues, should be stripped of the right to vote, shouldn't have any voting rights until polygamy is out of the picture. So that's an interesting argument. But the Mormon women form Utah Women's Suffrage Association, which is an affiliate of Susan B. Anthony's organization. They continue to cultivate those national ties. And you can see here in the center is Bathsheba W. Smith's membership ticket to the Salt Lake County Women's Suffrage Association. There were 19 counties with these suffrage associations then. So what really changes the game for Utah women's rights is that the Mormon Church disavows polygamy officially in 1890, right? And we know the story. Then Congress invites Utah to officially apply again for statehood. And so this becomes a contest then that will play out in the Utah Constitutional Convention of 1895. The suffragists in Utah work really hard to lobby the different delegates that will be there, and they think they have this in the bag. There's widespread support, and has been widespread support for decades in Utah for women's voting rights. But at the Constitutional Convention, the debate about this equal suffrage clause ends up taking 2 weeks. And part of that is due to B.H. Roberts, a Mormon apostle and delegate who argues against suffrage in very forceful terms. He kind of surprises all the suffragists who thought he would support it. But he argues that including equal suffrage will potentially imperil the Constitution, that Congress might not accept it if women's suffrage is included here. And then he also argues that women shouldn't vote and should be in the kitchen and things like this. So he's got a lot of reasons there. But his most forceful opponent in this debate is Franklin S. Richards, who you can see on the right here with his wife, Emily. And he argues in favor of including women's suffrage, whether or not it imperils the Constitution, because it's the right thing to do. And we're going to talk about him a little bit later. But in the end, this argument wins out. The delegates overwhelmingly vote to include this constitutional plank in the Constitution, and then male voters in November of that year also overwhelmingly approve this Constitution. And it's approved by Congress, approved by the President, and Utah becomes a state in 1896 as the third suffrage state. Interestingly, this little blurb on elections and right of suffrage in the Utah Constitution reads that the right of citizens of the state of Utah to vote and hold office shall not be denied on account of sex. Both male and female citizens of this state shall enjoy equally all civil, political, and religious rights and privileges. And this is really radical language. This is language that's actually given to Utah suffragists by Susan B. Anthony, but it also reads really similarly to the Equal Rights Amendment. And if we had time, we'd talk about that today, but that's not where we're going. But it's fascinating. So Utah then becomes, as the third suffrage state, part of this vanguard of states of women who are fighting for suffrage across the country. Utah women form the Utah Council of Women with Carrie Chapman Catt in 1899 and work then to promote the national suffrage amendment through other states. There's a sense that liberty is moving from the West to the East, that the march of civilization has perhaps been reversed in some ways. And so the suffrage movement, in many ways, rests on the achievements of these women out West who have gained the right to vote. They argue that if women are voting in Wyoming and Idaho and even Utah, then why not in New York? Which seems like a good question, right? And here you can see a picture of Utah women welcoming an envoy from San Francisco that was carrying a national petition to D.C. for suffrage. And they stopped here. You can see Emmeline B. Wells in the center front of that photo. Thank you, Naomi. On the steps of the Utah Capitol. This is in 1915. And thousands of Utah women were signing these petitions. So this was not the suffrage story in Utah was not one that ended in 1896. Even after women gained the right to vote nationally, Utah women, through the Relief Society, the Young Ladies Mutual Improvement Association, and other organizations, were key members of the National Council on Women and the International Council on Women. So Utah women were very involved in these early days of the women's rights movement. They're very involved all the way up through the 1940s and 50s. And we can talk about what happens later, but the story that we want to tell is that this story hasn't been well told already. We want women in Utah and everyone in Utah to understand the place that their cultural forebears or state foremothers have played. And there are a couple of reasons right now why this history hasn't been well told. And these are things that we're trying to combat. First of all, suffrage is kind of an overlooked part of U.S. history. I think we all think it's important, probably, but it's a story that has generally been told as something very cut and dry. We know everything that happened. It's not that interesting. There's nothing new left to discover. But it's also been told as one that really happens from the East Coast, even though all of the Western states gained suffrage long before Eastern states. So there's a question here about these assumptions about what is American history, and are Western women just an anomaly? And if you don't have to fight for your rights, then does your story matter? Although Utah women have an interesting relationship there. So that's another reason. Another reason is that the focus on national leaders sometimes obscures the women on the ground who are making things happen. And, you know, this is true in all aspects of history, but history from the bottom up hasn't quite yet reached the suffrage story. And we're trying to do a little bit of work to help that happen. And one last reason, as Catherine Breckus has noticed, is, of course, the Mormon issue here, that given the assumptions and the motivations of different historians in the past, sometimes this has been pitted as Mormon women are either these deluded, downtrodden slaves or fiercely independent matriarchs, and there's kind of no in between. And what we're trying to tell is a story of all Utah women, Mormon or not, but women who have agency both within and outside structures of power, and women who make choices given the constraints that they face in their life, but that those choices mattered, that they do make history, and that they shape what's happening here. So I'm going to turn it over to Naomi to talk a little bit more about why this story hasn't been as much told in Utah, and then what we're doing specifically to share and popularize this Utah women's history. Excuse me.
Thanks. So this is all. Some of this is just hunch, and some of it's speculation, as we've been talking about, talking to people more about the Utah women's suffrage story. So if you were like me growing up in the LDS church, I did not know about these women. Anyone else? Was that your personal experience? I did not know about these women until I was an adult. I may have heard their name in passing. I could tell you some big names like Eliza Snow or Emma Smith, right? But beyond that, I really didn't know very much about Mormon women's history except outside of my own family history, right? Because those were stories that my family told. But within the institution, I didn't really know anything about that. And when I did learn about them, I felt rather robbed that I had been, you know, that I did not grow up with this richness, that maybe that my experience as a young Mormon girl might have been different. Right? I mean, I don't know. I do know that as a young girl, I was reading biographies about American women, right? I was reading biographies about Betsy Ross or Martha Washington, right? Like the national foremothers, but not, there was nothing. And actually there still really is a dearth of material about Mormon women that's of quality that is targeted towards a youth audience. So I guess I'm on record for saying that. So, And we have seen in the national world like an emergence, right? If you have been looking around, there are a ton of books that are targeted towards kids about strong female role models, right? Like, so there's like these anthologies of different strong women, right? There's websites like A Mighty Girl, etc. So that is happening. Not just, you know, this problem is not just a Mormon problem or a Utah problem. It is a worldwide problem about uncovering the stories of women and making that part of the dominant and the big narrative of history. So my slide here is it's all about the men. That's partly why we don't know about these stories, right? And even this history is told from the point of view of the men, what the men did. Well, the male polygamists went to jail, right? And we don't really talk about what happened to the women so much. We talk about polygamy more so from a male perspective. How many wives did he have, right? Rather than, and more so now we're talking about polygamy in a much more transparent way. But this has been an issue. And we're talking about what the men said about women rather than what the women said about themselves, which is why I think Catherine's dissertation is so awesome, that she's looking at the way that women petition on their own behalf. So we're trying to make this now about a story that uses women's voices and that talks about their own civil liberties being taken away. It's not just the fact that polygamy was gone, but also the fact that they lost their own voting rights and other liberties. This next one, you know, again, if you're a woman, you probably, and you know, you've been defined by your marital status or lack thereof your entire life and will continue to be, but we've seen this recently, and Jen will talk about this more, about how Martha became, like, if you followed the news when her statue was being debated in the state legislature, a lot of people were upset about sending a polygamist to Washington and National Statuary Hall, but made no comment about Brigham Young, who's been there forever and ever, who was the grand poobah, right? So we see even in the way that Martha's described, the first thing that's said about her is that she's a polygamist wife. You know, it's her marital status that's the most important thing in this list. And, you know, and Catherine and I were talking about this on the way down when we drove down here from Salt Lake, that when Brigham Young's talked about, I've never heard him referred to as a polygamous husband. He's called a polygamous leader. Like, that polygamy is the adjective for his leadership, not about him actually being a husband or a father. And we see this with women even today. When people talk about, ask women about their careers, they really want to talk more about their family and how they balance it all. And so this is an ongoing problem. And this quote obviously comes just from a couple months ago. This was in the Salt Lake Tribune. So the other thing, and this can be a whole topic all in itself, and if you're familiar with Carolyn Pearson's The Ghost of Polygamy, she touches a lot on this, as to why we don't talk about these stories, particularly in the LDS Church. It's been interesting talking about the Utah story to Eastern women. So when I had a meeting with the current leaders of the National Women's Party, and they didn't know anything about the Utah story, and I told them about it, and they were fascinated, like totally fascinated. And talking to a lot of Utahns, particularly those who have ties to LDS Church, there's this like shame of not wanting to talk about the story because it talks about polygamy. And I thought this quote that I found in a recent article really draws that home. So you have two Utah state legislators. This is, again, when the debate for the statue was happening. You have Cheryl Acton. She says, these two polygamists, and she's referring to Brigham Young and Martha, really concern me. We've spent about 100 years trying to downplay that reputation of polygamy in the public at large and nationally, and that doesn't trouble you? Like, you know, essentially, how dare you bring this back up again, right? And Todd Weiler, who was the sponsor of this statue bill, he says, I don't know that, but just by having Philo there for the last 30 years has changed the fact that we have a polygamist history. Rather than hiding in shame, I think we ought to be emphasizing some of the remarkable things about it. And, you know, you could we're not here to argue today about the remarkable things about polygamy, and whether that is even the case. But I do think it's interesting, right, this idea, like, we don't want to talk about it because it brings up feelings in us, or it makes us look, I don't know, weird, or whatever it is. The other thing from an educational standpoint, you know, it's interesting that Catherine talked about how suffrage is kind of this thing that seems to be said and done, and it's not talked about because it's suffrage. When you look at the National Social Studies Standards for Kids, so K through 12 education, the National Women's History Museum, which does not have a physical location yet, they are lobbying and trying to raise money to have that on the National Mall. They just recently did a study of all of the state social studies standards and looking at how women and minorities appear. And I've just pulled the ones about women. And you'll notice that they prioritize listing one of them accomplishment, right? So kids may learn about Susan B. Anthony, they may learn about Martha Washington, but they don't learn about other women who are more, quote, everyday type women. It doesn't collectively address the breadth and depth of women's history, right? It's not just that, you know, women were doing these domestic things or maybe they got voting rights, but there was a lot of breadth, like showing the multiplicity of women's lives. And what I thought was interesting, and I was kind of surprised by this actually, is this overemphasis on women's domestic roles. Like, that's about, like, they just did the cooking and cleaning while the men did all these other things, which isn't true. The thing that's interesting, too, is that when you talk about women's history, voting rights, suffrage is usually mentioned. It's in textbooks. What's interesting is that the state of Utah recently adopted new grade 7 through 12 social studies standards, and the Utah studies class, so that is grade 7, suffrage does not appear. So, which they are now, like, being very apologetic and bending over backwards to do things about, to correct that oversight. But, I mean, it does speak to something, right, that that even the people creating the standards aren't making this history a priority. And so, you know, I'm going to talk to you about the educational curriculum that we've been working on, but without those tools, kids in schools aren't learning about it either. And what a great place to have these conversations about voting rights being granted and taken away and all of those things, and talking about how people could and could not vote. And again, they don't reflect current scholarship. So those are some of the reasons why, like, this history isn't talked about and our kids aren't learning about it, not just in church, but also in the public schools. So the thing that I've been working on for the past year with Catherine and Barbara, who's now here, hello, Barbara, is developing curriculum around the story that teachers can use in their classrooms. And so the thing that we launched last month is a website called UtahWomen'sHistory.org. And on here, these are some screenshots of the website. We've started with the suffrage story and realizing that that is not the only thing that women did in history. Our goal is to eventually expand this, that there will be curriculum and lesson materials that talk about Utah women's history in an expansive way, right? And making sure that this is not just a white Mormon story, right? That this is a story about all Utahns. And what the story, who the story left out, and who, you know, the history left out, right? So we started with grades 4 and 7 because those are the Utah studies classes. So they are learning about the Utah story, essentially the outline that Catherine just told you. The seventh grade lessons really focus on those political cartoons. I think they're really, like, captivating. So all of those materials are free, open access. You could even use them if you wanted to yourself. There are things there, too, for families and kids and just adults. It's a great place to learn about the story yourself. So on here, besides the curriculum, there's an extensive timeline that talks about voting rights, not just in Utah, but also nationally, because we fit in within that national narrative. And we are creating these illustrations and biographies about Utah women. So you may have seen these throughout the slides. So one of my things when I first started working for Better Days is I was like, we really need to find something that's captivating to kids. They do not want to look at, or they don't find that very engaging to look at black and white photos of stern-looking women with buns. Like, that's just not, like, something that's really enticing. And then, and even to me, they start to look the same. I mean, I know that's like, but they do. And so we hired illustrator Brooke Smart. She's here based in Utah, and she's going to be illustrating 50 illustrations of who we're calling women advocates in Utah, right? So you'll see here, you probably have heard of Emmeline B. Wells, right? The editor of the Woman's Exponent, and she was also the General Relief Society president for decades, and was in charge of the wheat saving project that the LDS Church did. You may or may not have heard of Hana Kaiapa, who was an immigrant from the Sandwich Islands and settled in Yosepa. She actually traveled with Utah suffragists like, who is it that she went with?
Martha
and several other prominent LDS women, and traveled to Washington, D.C. Thank you, Susa Young Gates. Like, their names are escaping because I'm here standing in front of you talking. And traveled with them to Washington, D.C. and spoke at this national conference on behalf of the Hawaiian women. And then she dined with national suffrage leaders, which, I mean, that's really cool. And, you know, Martha, we have Zitkala Saw, who is a Native American woman activist. She's from the Sioux tribe and lived here in Utah for 14 years. And the thing that's fascinating to me about her is that she was a talented musician. She actually composed the first Native American opera with a BYU professor. All of her papers are housed at BYU. Her Anglo-white name was Gertrude Bonin, so if you want to go look them up, that's how you would find her. So she writes this opera. She also writes in the Atlantic Monthly and all of these different national publications about the Native experience, talking about her experiences being taken to a white boarding school, and then she and her husband eventually move to Washington, D.C. and start these national organizations fighting for Native American voting rights, and, you know, citizenship and different rights. So that's Zitkala Saw. So our goal, Catherine and I have been working on finding women, right? And it's not necessarily that there's a lack of them. It's deciding how do you narrow it down to 50, right? I mean, that's a good problem to have. Our rule is they have to be deceased to get an illustration. But we are uncovering, too, a lot of women of color in Utah in this time period that their stories are not told at all. Their names are not known. And so what will be happening with these, you can get these illustrations now, but for school kids, we're turning them into what we're calling trading cards, although they're going to be 4x6 cards. And then on the back, there'll be an actual photograph of the women, so you can actually see what they really did look like, and then information about who they were. So the publisher, Gibbs Smith, which many of you may know, they actually publish most of the state social studies textbooks, and we have partnered with them, and they are giving every Utah studies teacher a set of 20 of these cards for free. So I know, it's like a huge win, and we're like hoping to have those out in the fall. So, you know, it's been fun for me personally to find my own history, but also to learn about the history of these other women who were a part of Utah that I did not know about. The other thing that we're working on is, did you know that Salt Lake City has more standing suffrage sites than Seneca Falls? Well, now you do. You can use that as a dinner conversation or lunch today. Did you know? So we're working on a downtown suffrage walking experience, or like a tour, right? We've all gone to cities and done different tours. If you've been in Salt Lake at all, you know, a lot of the tours are dominated by the LDS Church, and now there seems to be more buses and things that you can go on a Segway tour of downtown Salt Lake City now. But we're working on this being an interactive, kind of like Pokemon Go, you know, not just like these plaques, but that you could actually wander around Salt Lake City and learn about how the Tabernacle was the spot where Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton came and they spoke. And a lot of people, even growing up Mormon, have no idea that that these sites that we think of as religious places have this actual, like, this history in our political world. And so we have to fundraise for this, but this is our eventual goal, that there will be something, augmented reality, things that you can actually, like, so you could see what the buildings looked like back in that day. Currently, on the website, there is the old school, like, you can print off a PDF of the tour. So you could go and do it. It's a 3-mile loop that starts at the Council Hall building, which is just south of the Capitol building, and then ends up back at the Capitol. But if you're like me, I mean, that's downhill and then back uphill, if you are familiar with the terrain. And Salt Lake City blocks are long, so you could drive it. But that is one of our goals. And so kids could take that field trip or that tour as part of the Capitol tours that they often already do, right? Or if you're here with your family and you're trying to find something to do and you've, like, done the Temple Square thing ad nauseum, right, that you can go and do something else and learn more about Salt Lake in a very different way. And so, I think, Jen, it's you.
Wow.
We actually are really excited about all of these projects, and one of my personal favorites and that I have been working on during this last legislative session. Oh, we're going to go back one more. So every state gets to put two statues back in National Statuary Hall. So 100 statues there, bronze, marble, 9 of them currently are women. And right now Kansas is working on a statue of Amelia Earhart, so we will have 10. But during 2018, during the legislative session, there was a resolution to put a statue of Dr. Martha Hughes Cannon back in National Statuary Hall. Naomi gave you a little bit of context. Martha was amazing. She served for one term. During that term, the legislation that she passed includes what today is the State Department of Health. She had 4 degrees by the time she was 25. She was a doctor. She'd gone back east. She'd gone to Brigham Young and asked to be called to go and earn her medical degree. And she worked as a typesetter for the Exponent while she was here in Utah and went to the University of Deseret and got her chemistry degree and then went back east and did 2 other medical degrees beyond that. And then also while she was at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, decided that she wanted to have a way to be able to talk about what she felt like needed to happen in medicine. And so she enrolled in a school of elocution and oratory, and her 4th degree was in that. So by the time she got back to Utah, she was a doctor, she was a skilled speaker, she had an opportunity, she was a resident physician at the hospital, and then she got back involved in the suffrage movement. And because of her work and because of her election and because of the things that she did, we have opportunities to vote today. She was this early model and early leader of what it meant to be a woman in the public space and what it means to be able to be involved in the civic life of your community. So we're really excited about that statue. Her statue will be placed. This is an existing statue right now. It stands behind the Capitol. There are 4 statues in the park area back there. And the commission, the RFP for this new Martha statue will go out in the next month or so to artists across the state. And we will hopefully have a sculptor selected by the beginning of 2019 so that in August of 2020, when we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, her statue will go into National Statuary Hall. The other thing that I, as this legislation came up, and as we were surprised as it got to the House by the amount of rancor around it. It was something initially that we thought would just be a no-brainer, like what a great idea to put a statue there. And we were surprised by the amount of pushback and the amount of people that, and the conversations that were happening around it. We felt like it was very illustrative of maybe some of the concerns that Utah women have today. It matters to us to have statues of women in our public iconography, because what we say we value, we should see in the images around us. And we need more statues of women. We need more of statues of real women. When you go back to DC now, there's statues of Columbia and statues of Liberty and statues of ideals, but not statues of actual real women. And that's one of the reasons why this matters. In public spaces, I'm also really excited about the First to Vote license plate that will be available this October. I love the visuals of this. Again, so October 1st, this will be available at the DMV. This can be your license plate. When you talk about art in public spaces, license plates are not one of those initial things that you think about, but I challenge you today, after I've said license plate now 5 or 6 times, to not notice them as you're driving down the street. So Utah has, there's 3 plates that are just the regular plates. There's the Ski Utah plate, there's the Centennial plate with the arch on it, and then there's the new In God We Trust. And then there's special group plates. And so this is one of those special group plates, and it'll just be available when you're registering your car. The opportunity for this to be driving around the streets of Utah is incredible, because as students are learning about this and hearing about this, and then just in places, like, this is history that will be coming alive for them as they see that all around. We're also working right now, the website that Naomi has been working on and developing, we're working on a map component of it that will include local suffrage histories. So divide down by county and then by and also by reservation, and you'll be able to click on your geographic location and find the stories of the local of local suffrage, local suffragists, and that history in that place. That is a huge undertaking, we're finding. And we need help with that, and would invite you, as you have those suffrage stories or know of those or have contacts in those areas, we're working with partners across the state, the Utah Association of Counties, we're working with the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, we're reaching out into the legislative histories to find the women and the stories of people that have been involved there. We are working on street renamings. We have events that we're planning. There's a speaker series, and all of these different ways are ways that we're trying to educate, to popularize Utah's women's history in these creative and communal ways that bring people together and give us an opportunity to talk about that. The reasons that this are important. Utah women's advocacy is part of our cultural DNA. We have women like Emmeline, who for more than 35 years edited the Women's Exponent. That advocacy, the values of that are things that we should be carrying forward today. The value of women's education. When Martha arrived in Philadelphia back in the mid-1870s, she was the only woman in her class. And she worked so hard to be able to pay for those degrees and earn that. That value of women in education. Those are part of our cultural DNA important to us today. The support of community. This is a story, this suffrage story is a story of community. It's a story of people coming together. In 1870, when women were granted that first initial right to vote, there were no women that were voting for themselves to be able to vote. It was all a story of coming together and of women, of men, women and men doing that together. The same thing happened in 1896. And then the women turned around and were part of that national movement as well. We just recently, in conjunction with the political science department down at BYU, had them do some studies and work for us and found that Utah women's history and knowing the stories of what happened here make people more proud to be Utahns. And that's an important piece of being able to construct and tell the narrative of what it means to be a Utah woman today. Those are the kind of tools that we have that will change how we talk about being a Utah woman. Did you know that when Astra Jimenez takes her spot in the fall this year at UVU as the president, that 5 of Utah's 10 universities will be headed by women? That's an incredible thing, and goes against some of the other stories, you know, that we're hearing about. And we need to be aware of what's happening and talking about the advances that are being made and recognizing those, as well as acknowledging the. Also, this week there was a study in the Deseret News published an article that showed that women community leaders have actually decreased. In 2014, heads of corporations were at 11.6%, and now in 2018 we're down to 6.4. So we need to be able to own all of those pieces and be able to talk about them and then be able to take that and decide what we're going to do moving forward. Studies show that women, when they see that they can make a difference in their communities, get more involved. And as we tell these stories of these incredible women from these years ago, we're showing that we were involved and that we can still be involved, and it will make a difference in our business, economic, and political communities. We have an ask. At the end, of course, ways to get involved with us. We need help with our research and our writing. We need volunteers that are willing to do some of this research, to help us build these local histories, to find and source those stories for us. We invite you to follow us on social media and engage with what's happening there. There's history, there's events, there's all sorts of different interesting and compelling things that are happening around the state. We invite you to sponsor an event, to host an event, to take this celebration and decide what your organization, what you want to do to celebrate that. And as always, as Naomi mentioned, it takes a lot of money to run these projects, and so we're always looking for donations as well. This history matters, and we're grateful for the chance to be here today and to talk to you a little bit about it. I'm gonna let Catherine bring it all home.
Well, I think that was all the wrap-up we needed, but we're going to end with a quote from Franklin Richards. This was during the constitutional debates in 1895, and he argued that equal suffrage will prove the brightest and purest ray of Utah's glorious star. It will beckon our sister states and territories upward and onward to the higher plane of civilization and the fuller measure of civil and religious liberty. And we really like this vision. It's a vision that has not yet been completely fulfilled in Utah, this vision of equal rights for women, equal participation. And we'd like to tell a story that includes all Utah women's participation and contributions to our state so that we can encourage and inspire future generations of Utahns to work towards that better future that was envisioned by so many of these leaders of the past. So with that, I'll just open it up for questions if we have any.
It seems, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that many of the leaders of the suffrage movement in Utah were polygamous wives. Is that the case? And if so, what, obviously we'd be speculating, but what role do you think that might have played in their, what we might call early adoption of the suffrage movement?
So yes, in the early generations, the suffrage leaders were definitely usually polygamous women. As Mormon women sought to build relationships with national organizations and improve their image, especially even before 1890, but especially post-1890, some of the younger generation of monogamous women, like Emily Richards, who was married to Franklin, began to take a forefront. So perhaps they were the presidents of organizations where the older generation of women were in other positions. So there was definitely that. I think there's a lot of history argumentation about why or why not polygamy may have facilitated or inhibited other things. But generally speaking, we see that women, through their organizational networks in the Relief Society and through family and kinship networks that were built from polygamous marriages, I think really that's where they found their support to do their work. And an interesting point that we've made about Utah women here is that they were generally pushing for this, at least with the suffrage, they were pushing for rights for women with the support of the entire community, generally speaking, as LDS women, rather than against their communities, as many women who were fighting for suffrage in other places had to deal with. So I think that played a role as well. Was that a cop out?
Yeah. So I'm really excited about this app of the downtown suffrage sites. Any projections yet on when that might be available?
It all comes down to money.
So when funding is available.
So I mean, we have the concepts like what you saw. I mean, they're a little more fleshed out than that. But we are working with like Silicone Slopes and hoping perhaps that work will be donated so that they'll create the apps themselves. So we're working on those relationships to make that happen. When we want it to happen? I mean, ideally, it'd be great to have it in fall of next year, 2019, right? Going into the year 2020. So say lots of prayers and cross fingers and all of those things.
I just wanted to commend you young women for carrying the ball forward. And I was, not aware of women's history when I was growing up. And then I got into it later in life. And so in 2004, Signature Books published my book, The Sum of Our Past, Revisiting Pioneer Women. And it's out of print now, but I covered a lot of the suffrage and Emmeline B. Wells and so forth like that. So I'm glad you're carrying that on. And I think that makes such a difference to young women to have those role models. And then in answer to the question about the role polygamy played in women working for women's suffrage, many of them had sister wives to watch the children or when they went back to college or back to medical school. And so that was an advantage. And then also I say, well, how did, they do all these things? Well, also many of them had servants too. So if modern women had servants, maybe we could accomplish even more.
the story of those, that the inspiration that, that has been, I mean, that was our founding story. The COO of our organization was completing her bachelor's degree and reading about all of these studies that were happening that showed, you know, like the one in the Deseret News, the decrease in women in leadership and where Utah sits on all of the national statistics for women involved in elected office, or women in elected office, women involved in boards and commissions and levels of education, and then reading about the women that you wrote about and the women that we're talking about today, and wondering where, how we could get from the progression of the past and carry that forward into today. It's been inspiring to go and to talk about Martha in places. And I had someone come up recently, and she's a medical student in New York. And, you know, and she said to me, she was talking about something that had just recently happened and some disappointment and a professor that had told her that she couldn't do what she wanted to do. And she's like, I know Martha's story. I can do this. I can go forward. And those are the kind of, that inspiration that, that keeps us going.
So we already are seeing the effect of the curriculum in schools, like how kids are reacting to it. And I just want to add that. So if you have kids who are in Utah schools, or grandkids or nieces and nephews, et cetera, like the way to get this taught is to make teachers aware of it, right? I mean, that's one of the big challenges. There's so many materials and all of that, and making teachers aware. But kids, which you got to love kids because they see fairness and equality so cleanly, right? And so when they learn that women didn't have the vote, they're like stunned. I mean, they don't even know the world without a phone. But like, what do you mean women couldn't vote? And not even all women could vote. And, you know, they have this very like strong sense of equality, and then get very indignant when they find out that those rights were taken away and that the women had to fight to get them back. And we are seeing students getting inspired by the story and becoming like actively involved in their communities and politically too. So when the statue was, you know, being debated, and we were actually really nervous that we weren't going to get the yes votes, kids around the state started writing their state legislators about like why they wanted Martha, right? And drawing pictures and all kinds of things, right? I mean, they were beautiful, these great letters. And we saw those things make a difference in changing, softening the hearts, right, of some of our state legislators and changing their minds. And so that has real power, right? I mean, if you think about your own schooling, I mean, I can remember the pivotal projects in my schooling as a kid that made a difference that I still remember. I may not remember the teacher, whoever that did it, but I remember the impact that it had on me. And so as an educator myself, I find that really inspiring. So it's not even just about the Utah history and making these women known. It's also making kids aware that these issues that happened in the past about voting rights are still being debated now. Like, these are current issues, even though we're talking about the past. So, rah, rah, rah. What time is it? Are we done? Okay. 3 minutes.
I know. So as far as, was this something that really started... seemed to start, like, how organic was this in growing? Was this something that really started in Utah, definitely in the Utah period, or were there stirrings about women's rights even before then within Mormonism, like even in Nauvoo and that type of stuff?
Yeah, if we're talking about Mormon women's involvement, I think absolutely this is a story that goes further back. Many suffrage leaders who were writing petitions in the 1870s and 80s were the same women who had written petitions in the 1830s and 40s trying to get redress for lost property in Nauvoo or in Missouri. So I think it's a story that reaches back to their political socialization and their experience of persecution, and the way that they framed that and what the lessons they drew from that experience. So there's absolutely, I think there are reasons why it could happen in the post-Civil War world that it couldn't have happened before, right? And there are national conversations driven by polygamy that allowed this moment to occur in Utah history, I think. So I think you have both. This doesn't happen in isolation. We all know that there are forces and structures and systems beyond our control, right? But then there's individual experience and agency, and decisions made by individual people that turn those hinges of history. So I think that's how it fits. Yeah. Yeah, please.
So Sarah M. Kimball, would you say
Yeah.
Just adding to what Catherine said, I wanted to share a quote by Sarah M. Kimball, who was a major force in the suffrage movement in Utah. She's the woman who had the idea to start the Relief Society in Nauvoo in 1842. And she said, I'm paraphrasing, but she said, the Mormon women's suffrage effort, or, you know, our movement for women's rights started in March of 1842 when we founded the Relief Society. So there's that founding.
She's also the woman who, after women gained voting rights, she said, now I can declare myself a women's rights woman. So I thought that's interesting.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for the...